Hello, you are listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. In this episode, you'll hear two presentations from a panel on C.S. Lewis and the world at our March 2026 conference in Omaha. First, Rod Miller of Hendricks College will present That Hideous Job. He is followed by Clayton Carver with The Pursuit of Happiness, a Lewisian perspective on the American dream. Here's the panel. Enjoy.
Good morning, I'm Rod Miller. Well, welcome to this session on C.S. Lewis and the world. Let's start with prayer, shall we? Father, we're just grateful that you bring us here this morning. We just ask you to open our hearts, open our minds, continue to teach us how to love you more and to love each other more, Father. Thank you. Amen. So, I have to introduce myself, which is really strange. Dr. Rod Miller. I'm a professor of art history at Hendricks College in the central part of Arkansas, right in the middle of Arkansas, or as all of you know it, God's country. And I've written several books that no one has ever read or have purchased. So my publications include C.S. Lewis and the Arts. I edited a volume of essays, and then a book called 23% More Spiritual, Christians and the Fad. It's kind of funny. And now I read on That Hideous Job. What does it mean to work for the academy today? Stupid and trite administrators, people out for their own gain, both political and ideological. No money for junior faculty, no money for senior faculty, no money for anything. Trivial fads in thinking, publishing. To deal with that and at the same time be in an exceptional minority position, a faithful Christian in a pagan environment, is not easy. Has the academy grown worse? If you work or have worked for any part of the academy, you get the setting for Lewis's 1945 novel, That Hideous Strength. It's one of the great joys of the book. The academy is a mess and has been so for a long while. Those in the academy who embrace the faith understand that the academy is unfair, biased, tyrannical, and often just stupid. Those who do not embrace the faith also understand that the academy is unfair at all. The difference is that the former recognize the travails as part of human life, of a fallen world, of Screwtype messing about, the latter often to believe that the academy holds the keys to cultural transformation and a utopian future. There used to be rules for the academic battles. Follow reason, avoid the ad hominem, freedom of speech. All of these being ignored are displayed in That Hideous Strength. Note that the title of That Hideous Strength uses strength in the older way. I hope all of you know that already. Fortress. The academy is and has been for a long time a fortress. Perhaps when founded by Christian priests in England or Puritans in America, these were the fortresses of truth. They are not so any longer. What Lewis offers to we happy few is the academy in all of its lack of glory. We are lent insight into the bizarre and tragic thinking of academics. At Bracton, we see them trying to gain power, wealth, prestige, and ultimately seeking what they know not, to the detriment of and downfall, and in some cases, death. The reader grasps what the vapid academics cannot. The battle is not against flesh and blood. Instructive is the manner in which Lewis builds the story, not with a Christian in that environment, but rather with the tragically lost and corrupted academics. Lewis gives us a behind-the-scenes view, so to speak. This is useful in that perhaps what Christian academics need is not visions of heroic Christians standing up for the truth and winning victoriously, but a better understanding of what leads some materialist academics to pursue what they do and to act as they do. This structure provides for the thoughtful Christian reader several advantages. We get to see something of a glimpse into the minds of those who enter higher ed for reasons other than the pursuit of truth. These are rather typical academics in the academy. There is a desperation for many of the characters to be on the inside, to gain a kind of power or influence. Curry, for example, is after power, but doesn't seem to quite grasp what else might be happening. Others, perhaps Philostrato, are after the fat. Sorry, I'm assuming that you all are familiar with the book, so. Okay, good. Philostrato are after the fad, whatever the contemporary current trend might be, to create artificial trees so there's less mess. Remember, that was such a great, yeah. Some are just out of their bloody minds. Wither, the head of Nice, cannot answer one of Studdock's questions straight up, which is, I have a provost who's like that. To be noted here, not a single one of the characters in Bracton nor in the Nice are Christian. The one character who stands up to the new thinking is rudely called Bill the Blizzard. He's not Christian. He's rather an old school materialist. One thinks of Kirkpatrick, who thinks nice nonsense. And for his troubles, he's beaten to death. In the midst of the sadly and lost bizarre Bracton and Ice setting, Lewis pulls us further in with a close-up view via that most typical young academician, Mark Studdock. We read as Mark attempts to negotiate the madness of his college and the Nice. From the first scene with Mark, we pick up on major issues and themes. Mark picks up on nothing. He loves being a part of the in crowd. Curry says, "we," and this was still sweet in his mouth. Mark is curious. Feverstone doesn't really deserve his job as a fellowship holder. Mark says if he had to explain Feverstone's never being on campus in public, i.e. to normal people, he would be hard-pressed. We quickly learn that a naive protagonist is most useful for the tale as we see what he does not. These are nice people, but they're not nice people. See what I did there? Okay. During his first meeting with Wither, after a rambling and vapid non-answer to what job he might actually be doing, Mark replies, "Oh, I do think that's so important. The elasticity of your organization is one of the things that attracts me." It is such a daft response that Lewis, the narrator, prefaces it by writing, "God forgive," quote, "God forgive him, for he was young and shy and vain and timid all in one." Lewis just jumps in. But Mark plows on. He cannot see the madness of Wither when trying to discern only the most basic information about the new job at Nice, and prevaricates into a maddeningly and funny obtuse manner. The descent continues over and over again. Mark sees without seeing. Does he have a position or not? Is he in? Is he out? Mark does not really act, however, until he is essentially accused of murder. When locked in his cell, the reader follows Mark doing something it appears he'd never done before: reflect over his existence and past decisions, particularly after the spiritual attack he suffers when he's locked up. We are seeing, if one may put it this way, the divine humiliation of a man. That is, Mark is beginning to see himself as he ought, the world as he ought, corruption as it ought. His wisdom grows when he realizes Jane would have been and will be better off without him, and that Frost and Wither are his enemies. During the therapy with Frost, Mark tries to bring matters back to good and bad. Frost keeps pushing it away from those terms. Quote, "On what grounds henceforward were actions to be justified or condemned?" But Mark grasps, quote, "The philosophy which Frost was expounding was by no means unfamiliar to him. He recognized it at once as the logical conclusion of thoughts which he had always hitherto accepted and which at this moment he found himself irrevocably rejecting." In the therapy room, Mark encounters something that changes him. He sees the perversions for what they are, the degradation and humiliation for what they are, and he became aware, and it's a longer quote, forgive me, as he had never been aware before of this room's opposite. As the desert first teaches men to love water, or as absence first reveals affection, there rose up against this background of the sour and the crooked some kind of vision of the sweet and the straight. Something he vaguely called the normal apparently existed. It was all mixed up with Jane and fried eggs and soap and sunlight and the rocks cawing at Keir Hardy and the thought that somewhere outside daylight was going on at that moment. He was not thinking in moral terms at all, or else what is much the same thing. He was having his first deeply moral experience. All of this is to ask, do we ever think of our lost colleagues going through some similar process? Anything like this, of demonic attacks on them? Because we can see this from Mark's perspective, we understand why he does what he does, at least in part. Do I ever consider what my colleagues are going through? What is my response to colleagues who are pursuing the demonic? Are they evil, trendy, weak, like Jane and Mark? Like pretty much all the characters in the book? How ought the Christian respond? Lewis's answer to that is carried in a manner that is subtle, realistic, and satisfying, I'd suggest. This moment, but six pages, is profound not for Mark, nor for any of the characters, but for the Christian reader. Mark goes to Dimble. This is the only moment in which Mark encounters a Christian face to face. Dimble agrees to meet with him, even when he's convinced that Mark had a hand in torturing Jane, that he is neck deep in the Nice, and that he's always found him a bit of a prat. Mark thinks, sorry, that's British English there, so I thought you would enjoy, I thought I'd get a chuckle. That's no, bit of a prat. Okay, well, Mark thinks he will confront Dimble and learn Jane's location. He is stunned to learn that she really was tortured. He tries to put on a tough facade. Stop posturing, says Dimble. Lewis shares Mark's thoughts during the meeting, but he also shares Dimble's. He's not expecting Mark, and isn't it always like that? That moment, like, oh, we have to talk about it now? He is shocked to see the change in Mark's face, fatter and paler and a new vulgarity in the expression. Dimble knows something of Mark's childish aspirations, knows he is a typical young academic, but unlike the reader, he does not know all. Of course not, and neither do we when we have those annoying, frustrating, maddening, and seemingly random encounters. Dimble tries to respond with charity. Mark sees his serious struggle as dislike or distaste. Dimble's trying very hard, we are told, not to hate. Mark does not know that, and Dimble does not know what is happening in Mark's head. What does he do? What would you do? Dimble takes a risk. He thinks he sees an opening for Mark and offers him a way out. No guarantees, but maybe. As Mark slouches away from the offer, Dimble presses, "We may neither of us live through the next hour." But to no avail, Mark leaves and is quickly arrested for murder. Dimble reflects and worries that he did not do enough, that if, quote, if he had been wiser and more perfectly in charity, maybe he could have helped. He wonders if he lost his temper, showed his anger, was self-righteous. This moment ends with his humbling reflection from Brother Lawrence, quote, "Thus I shall always do whenever you leave me to myself." Would any of us have responded better? How much does Dimble actually help Mark with his spiritual struggle? Will Mark ever know what Dimble was attempting to do for him? Will Dimble ever learn how he guided or inspired or helped Mark? In fact, Mark never again in the novel encounters Dimble. The Christian is not called to know what will happen, but to be obedient. Dimble operates on his own at his college, alone. With whom might he or we speak about work, meaning, and truth within the pagan academy? In the novel, the two Christian academics have a loyal ragtag group, but they are at the home of the Pendragon. In Bracton, the talk is thus and is annoyingly familiar and alienating. And I'm quoting a small section from the book here. "As you chaps know, I make no claim to orthodoxy, but if religion is understood in the deepest sense, I have no hesitation in saying that Curry, by being in the nice, bringing the nice to Edgestow, has done more for it in 1 year than Jewell has done his whole life." "Well," said Curry modestly, "that's rather the sort of thing one had hoped. I might have put it exactly as you do, James." "No, no, no," said the bursar. "Of course not. We all have our different languages, but we all really mean the same thing." "Really? Do we?" To quote one example rebuttal, quote, "Since positivism only admits the pursuit of knowledge via a positivist viewpoint, then evidence offered in the attempt to escape its dogma is judged to be admissible only if it's positive." However the Christian deals with that is sure to be alienating. While the preponderance of the academy seeks whatever trend is of the moment, whatever demonic or selfish or irrational ends, the Christian seeks the eternal, lasting, and perennial. We do not all mean the same thing. Excuse me. How ought the Christian academic think of their academic work? While perhaps the scientist still has a hope of referring to an agreed-upon, verifiable realm, what does the humanist have to stand upon? How do I describe my work if it is not being directed by the demonic? Am I able to put words to that? I'm an art historian. The most ridiculed of all the humanities. It's great. Obama made fun of art historians. I don't know if you remember that. That was great. I show that to my students. It's great. Am I able to put words to that? There is no neutral ground. Empiricism itself is not neutral. My own field is art history. Upon what basis is art thought to be of quality? That's a fun question. That basis for the Christian or other wisdom-seeking traditions, is it true, good, wise? Not much more demoralizing and alienating than being asked, what is it you're working on? And giving an answer and receiving in return a blank look or some version of, oh, well, in your opinion. If we do meet with success, particularly publishing and acclaim, what then? The Christian and the pagan environment cannot forget how distinct and distant are our goals. We cannot forget that our colleagues who are not Christian have other goals. If it is not working for God, what can it be working towards? Why are we surprised when so much in the academy turns in the directions it has, and perhaps our teaching or publishing is not recognized? Maybe we should be careful when we're accoladed. Perhaps Groucho Marx's words were never more timely. He would never join a club that would have him as a member. What happens when we don't become famous, when no one reads what we've published, when we can't get published? With the transcendent tossed long ago, why would we expect anything else? This is a spiritual battle, and it does not end, and we keep fighting. We know or ought to know how our fighting, our struggling, is directed. We do not write and lecture and grade really awful essays to win fame, reputation, and certainly not fortune. Our struggles are different. We aspire to provide a mirror to the truth, to win souls, to instruct, to perhaps to delight, but all that we do is for God. When we lose sight of this, it becomes a lonely, tedious, and frequently annoying struggle. In conclusion, the conclusion. A final instructive part of that hideous strength is the ending. Some of the villains get justice. Mark and Jane get each other, but nothing is fully resolved. Exactly. The war continues. Running through THS is this theme. We are at war. We have always been at war, and now we are battling the enemy. That's why we pray beforehand, right? Is this not the Christian life? We're not guaranteed much regarding success in this life. We're promised the Spirit is near, Jesus understands, God sees all. If we were to receive any honor, maybe the next life. For now, there are no accidents. We are where God has placed us, and we have work, real work, to do. Thank you. Okay, our next speaker, Dr. Clayton Carver. He's a pastor in Missouri and an adjunct lecturer at Malaysia Baptist Theological Seminary. By the way, he's a recent PhD, so you can just give him a big round of applause for that. And he wrote his dissertation on a theological analysis of Lewis's argument from desire.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. 250 years ago, Thomas Jefferson's words spread through the American colonies and marked the birth of a new nation, and they formed the bedrock of American ideology and the notion of the American dream. They indicate that this new nation birthed not just a new government, but more importantly, the opportunity for each individual to pursue their own flourishing. Nonetheless, the idea of happiness and the means of its possession have been understood differently throughout history. To that end, this paper will explore the Christian idea of happiness and how it ought to be pursued. It does so in light of the ideas laid out by the American founders and tracing the idea of happiness and its pursuit into the present day. It then examines the notion of happiness found in C.S. Lewis, whose own pursuit of happiness was deeply intertwined with his Christian conversion story. Lewis is chosen as the Christian voice because he was well-read in the same classical literature that informed the American founders, yet he also testifies to the failures of pursuing happiness within a modernist framework. Thus, Lewis helps inform the classical notion of happiness, the failures of its modern form, and the hope provided by a Christian perspective on the topic. The fact that Jefferson includes the phrase, the pursuit of happiness, in the Declaration reveals the weight he placed on such a pursuit. In Jefferson's mind, happiness was the result of human flourishing, and he believed the bedrock of society was that people should be able to pursue such an existence. Jeffrey Rosen notes that Jefferson drew the idea from his reading of ancient philosophers, all of whom pointed to a single source as their influence, none other than our very own Cicero. In the traditional view, pursuing happiness was not so much about personal satisfaction as it was about cultivating a life that brings about the ideal existence for a human being. But this raises a natural question. What is the ideal kind of existence for a human being? If I could generalize, contemporary American society seems to define the ideal human existence as the immediate and maximal satisfaction of all personal desires, regardless of value or consequence. The founders did not see things this way. They viewed the ideal human existence as the development of a virtuous life for both the individual and society. Ben Franklin, for example, wrote that without virtue, men can have no happiness in this world. Franklin argued that people must regulate their emotions and desires by the use of reason to develop a harmonious and flourishing soul. Jefferson learned from Cicero the importance of pursuing happiness by cultivating a soul tranquilized by restraining and consistency. In other words, happiness is achieved through self-control rather than the immediate satisfaction of every desire. This may perhaps be an ironic understanding of freedom in our day, But the founders viewed freedom not as boundless liberty to do whatever feels good in the moment, but as a bounded liberty to make wise and virtuous decisions that will help each person develop their capacities and talents over the course of their life. However, if this helps answer the question as to the kind of existence that is ideal for humans, it still raises others. The founders speak of happiness as virtue cultivated through wise choices, but how is wisdom determined? Or to quote the book of Job, where is wisdom to be found? Apparently, this was a question for the founders as well. According to Rosen, Jefferson and the other founders were attracted to Scottish common sense philosophy, which taught that our minds have a natural moral sense that helps us overcome selfish desires and act virtuously towards others. Nonetheless, some questioned whether human reason alone was sufficient to allow men to subdue their passions and discover wise living. It is at the appearance of this question that Lewis has something to offer the discussion. Stuart Getz writes that, in Lewis's mind, nothing is more commonsensical than our desire to be happy. And just as commonsensical is our belief that the degree of happiness we desire cannot be had in this life. Lewis's personal search for happiness coincides with his search to satisfy a lifelong yearning for something that he could not identify, an experience he often referred to as joy or Sehnsucht. He believed that discovering what this longing was for was key to its satisfaction and to his own personal happiness. Being raised in the church, Lewis was not unfamiliar with the Christian ethical code. While this knowledge assisted with his conversion, it was also a point of criticism for Lewis because, in his experience, the church seemed to emphasize duty but never happiness, perhaps duty at the expense of happiness. Therefore, Lewis's resistance to God during his youth partly stemmed from the fact that God would make certain demands of him, the first of which was possibly the surrender of joy. This seemed counterintuitive to Lewis because if God was the object to which his desire was leading, then if God demanded he give up all pursuit of joy, the journey would be an apparent waste.
Could you give me my water, please? Sorry. Time out.
Nevertheless, all his reading, discussion, and reflection on the nature of reality led him to conclude that God waited at the end of the road, and this reality necessitated a certain kind of response. As such, Lewis fell in line with the American founders, viewing morality and obedience as to something or someone greater than himself as key to obtaining personal happiness. But then he goes one step further. Lewis discovered that he obtained the happiness he was searching for not in merely a virtuous life built on the contemplation of his own reason, but through obedience to the moral demands of the Christian God. Whereas Lewis initially thought the pursuit of happiness required the abandonment of any ethical code, especially one of Christian influence, his conversion journey ended with the realization that the path to happiness runs through the Christian moral life. Unfortunately, neither Lewis's nor the founder's view of happiness has persisted to the present day. Rosen notes that beginning in the 20th century, American views of happiness began to shift from a focus on being good to a focus on feeling good. This shift coincides with the rise of secularism, famously analyzed by Charles Taylor. In particular, two key factors of secularism are relevant for our discussion. The first is individualism. This characteristic shifts a society's focus from transcendent moral values onto the self. This removes a person from the divine created order that formed the foundation of Western society for centuries, forcing the individual to create their own meaning and identity. Thus, the pursuit of happiness is reduced to self-satisfaction, disconnected from any transcendent moral code. The second key factor is what Taylor calls the immanent frame. This is the worldview principle that nothing exists beyond the natural world, and therefore, all pursuits of happiness and satisfaction must be limited to the objects in the natural world, again reducing happiness to personal pleasure. Moreover, secular ethics require that each person be allowed to determine their standard for meeting purpose and identity. Such a requirement runs counter to the moral framework from which the Western world originated. By removing the universal and objective standard of reality, secularism places the burden of self-definition upon the individual. Whereas the objective standard of good provided humans a framework in which to operate, secularism essentially requires each individual to build their own value framework. While the idea of self-definition appears enticing to many, Scholars are noticing that it is making individuals less happy and more restless. In a more recent work, Benjamin Story and Jenna Story argue that the notion of restlessness and dissatisfaction is now a defining characteristic of American culture. Further, they demonstrate that the American democratic mindset assumes the possibility of achieving happiness within Taylor's imminent frame, and this possibility has formed a new kind of morality. They write, "Achieving happiness here and now appears to us not only as a desire, but as a duty. Imminent contentment becomes a command. This transformation heightens the restlessness endemic to the quest for imminent contentment, for it deepens our unhappiness by transforming it into a form of moral failure. This means that an individual is now a failure for not achieving contentment, but more importantly, it is morally wrong to deny the possibility of contentment as defined by an individual to someone else. The result of this mindset is that Americans often end up dispirited or depressed by the very pursuit of happiness. The stories conclude that the experience of unexpected dissatisfaction drives a restless love of change as we search for some improvement of our condition that will relieve the existential unease that afflicts us when prosperity satisfaction come to seem hollow and when others prove unable to give us the unmediated approbation we so ardently desire." This analysis, along with data and research that I do not have time to share, suggests that the secular view of happiness and its pursuit has failed. But what is the solution? Is it simply a return to the pursuit of a virtuous life, as the founders intended? Well, that would certainly help. But Lewis would argue that virtue alone is insufficient. He would say the founders were certainly correct to encourage people toward a virtuous life, and he even cites them in his final essay, "We Have No Right to Happiness." But he would also say that virtue alone does not achieve the desired outcome when done apart from the life that God designed humans to live. This kind of life is built on the foundation of knowing God through Jesus Christ, which transforms a person into a being that not only lives a virtuous life, but enjoys a virtuous life. Lewis illustrates his Christian understanding of morality through the image of a naval fleet, suggesting that morality occurs at three levels. First, the fleet must all sail in the same direction to avoid crashing into one another, meaning that all persons must adhere to the same moral law for it to be effective in creating harmony among individuals. At this first level, it immediately becomes apparent that Christian morality is externally focused and based on an external standard beyond human reason or selfish desire. Second, each individual ship must be in good working order, moving from harmony among persons to harmony within an individual. This suggests that true human flourishing, while requiring an external moral standard, also requires personal transformation. Thus, Christian morality is less about behaving in a certain way than it is about becoming a certain kind of person. It is not only informative, it is transformative. Third, the fleet must have shared knowledge of a common destination. In other words, humans must have an understanding of where morality leads, or the ultimate goal of a moral life. In this third aspect of Christian morality, Lewis teaches that morality, and by implication happiness, is not about pursuing something, but someone. Happiness is not the end. It is the result of the true end. Thus, his conclusion in Mere Christianity is not to look for happiness, nor is it to look for virtue, but to look for Christ. And by finding him, you will find everything else thrown in. The primary problem in the Christian view of morality, as Lewis explains in the opening chapters of Mere Christianity, is that humans do not operate this way. They do not have an organized fleet, either individually or collectively. He writes that all humans know they ought to behave a certain way, and yet they do not, echoing Paul's argument in Romans 1. Further, drawing from Genesis 3, humanity's goodness and happiness were lost because of its disregard of God's moral commands. He writes in The Problem of Pain, "It is claimed by Christianity that man, as God made him, was completely good and completely happy. But he disobeyed God and became what we now see. Thus, the logical conclusion is that if humanity's happiness was lost by rebelling against God, then it must be found in obedience to God." To summarize, it seems Lewis held two main beliefs about happiness. First, happiness is the intrinsically good state in which God intended humans to live, and it ought to be pursued. Second, according to Scripture, happiness must be sought in specific ways and through certain things to be ultimately achieved. For Lewis, happiness is not simply the reward for moral effort, but the fruit of a renewed relationship with God that reshapes human desires and enables the life of virtue the founders rightly admired. In this sense, Lewis does not reject the classical connection between virtue and happiness. He deepens it. Virtue is indeed the path to happiness, but only when it reflects the life that Christ calls humans to live, a life centered on Him. The ultimate point, then, is that happiness cannot be reduced to either the pursuit of pleasure or the cultivation of virtue alone. Rather, true happiness arises from a restored relationship with God and the transformed life that flows from it. As Lewis understood through his own journey, the pursuit of happiness ultimately becomes the pursuit of God Himself. And in that pursuit, humans begin to rediscover the life and the happiness for which they were ultimately created. Thank you.
You have been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. To learn more about us, our programs, and to sign up for our newsletter, please visit ciceroniansociety.org.